Hello, and welcome to Living Proof, the Isaac Newton Institute podcast. My name is Dan Aspel, and I'm your host. In today's episode, I'm joined by Maha Khoury of the Newton Gateway and Hannah Thomas of Government Analysis Function. Hannah specializes in communicating data, statistics, and analysis with a particular focus on accessibility. So she'll be telling us all about that and more. We hope you enjoy the episode. So here we are on the latest episode of Living Proof, and it's myself, Dan Aspel, and with me is my colleague Maha Khoury, who is the Scientific Knowledge Exchange Coordinator for the Newton Gateway.
Hello.
And we're really happy today to be joined by Hannah Thomas, who is, I think I'm getting this right, Hannah, Lead Support for Communicating Data, Statistics and Analysis at Government Analysis Function.
Yep, that's right. It's quite long, but yeah, that's right.
Brilliant. So I'll hand over to you two guys for a little bit, because the reason we're talking to you, Hannah, is that you were at the Newton Institute, is it 3 weeks ago now, Maha?
Yeah, roughly. Yes.
Roughly that. And I'll let you explain what context that was in.
Okay, so we met on the 24th and 25th of January for an event at the Isaac Newton Institute on Communicating Maths for the Public. So this was 2 days, and we covered various different topics to do with good practice, public experience, the pandemic and other emergencies, and then also we thought a bit about next steps for the communicating maths community. And this was quite a large event, so we had over 100 people at the Institute, and from that we met Hannah, who works at the Government Analysis Function, and then also we had a few other people from the civil service, as well as some quite big names like Hannah Fry and David Spiegelhalter to share their experiences. So that's how that went. So Hannah, what were your thoughts on the event?
Yeah, I really enjoyed it. I don't know, I feel people said it in the event, like, didn't expect the bit to be as good. Which I think, because if you've ever been to like a stats conference or a maths conference before, there's always... some of the presentations sometimes quite intense, and the person knows a lot about it but doesn't necessarily know how to speak in front of a big audience. But I guess everyone who was asked to speak had some sort of, you know, was there because they were good at communicating in some way. So yeah, I thought it was really, really good, and it was quite daunting to have like statistical celebrities there. That was quite that was quite cool. It's an added bonus. I like that. But for me, it was I was quite tiring because I did not realise how far away Cambridge was from Neath. So I had to get up at like 5 to get a train, and then Jay. I had to go into London and then back out of London, which is. I've never done that before, but that was fun.
Yeah. Well, you were very energetic by the mid-afternoon when you were speaking then.
Yeah, no, I was. My hair had all gone. I'd curled all my hair, especially the one that had all fallen out.
I, at the risk of embarrassing you, Maha found a blog post which you put up earlier this month, and I really liked the line at the beginning where you said that you'd been away to Disneyland Paris not long afterwards, but that unexpectedly the Cambridge trip was as entertaining and definitely more inspiring.
Yes.
So with apologies to Disneyland Paris, but it's very much secondary.
I'm not a massive Disney file, so but that adds something to it. But yeah, it definitely was more inspiring because it was just really nice. I haven't been back in a university setting for such a long time, and I'd forgotten how lovely it is to be surrounded by people who know so much about their specialism, and that's what I just always find that really nice, and people just know a lot.
Yeah, and there were people there, Maha named a couple there, people from an independent setting, people who were representing other bodies, and I have to say I don't know a lot about Government Analysis Function, so I'm really keen to find out from you, Hannah, in a nutshell, what it is that organization does and what you do there.
Okay, so it's not so much an organization, it's like a network that's set up. So somebody high up in the service came in and had the idea of you should have functions, just like a finance function, an analysis function, a commercial function. So we kind of came out of that. Before that, I was working under the GSS, which is the Government Statistical Service. So the GSS still exists, but it kind of got amalgamated into the analysis function, and it's basically made up as a network of all the analysts who work across government. So And that's a bit vague. So there are analytical professions. There's like 7 analytical professions, and I can never remember all of them, so I'm not going to try and list them. But really, it's wider than that. It's anyone who's working with analysis. And the reason, one of the reasons my title is a bit longer is because it's not just analysis; it's data and stats and analysis. And analysis kind of covers all those things, but people don't always know that it covers all those things. So that is just trying to bring them all, everyone together to have a better network of all the people working on similar areas so they can communicate better and get the access to guidance that will be helpful for all of them, a lot of stuff like that. So, yeah.
Well, that's really interesting. And as someone whose understanding of it is about equivalent to that of a 5-year-old, what are all the analysts doing across the civil service?
So I used to run, I used to work in a team, and we used to run like the induction course where people enter in the GSS. So it wasn't the analysis function so much, but it was, the GSS covers quite a lot of the analysis function. And I used to be always really amazed at all the jobs people are doing, the different types of jobs they are doing across government. So they can be people, like I used to work, give a lot of advice on spreadsheets. So I give advice on spreadsheets that were about like fisheries in Scotland, and basically a spreadsheet that lists all the fish, all the different types of fish that are caught off Scottish waters. And then you'd be speaking to someone with obviously loads and loads of COVID work, loads of Brexit work, but then loads of like things for DCMS, I don't know what it's called now, but yeah, I'm not supposed to talk in acronyms, my digital culture, media and sports. So they could be, they'd have really interesting, completely different stats, but really interesting stats. So it's a massive range of, you wouldn't believe how much analysis goes on. And then sometimes there's people, analysts who work in departments who are just analysing the stats for that department. So just the head, you know, the business stats, like the head counts and the salaries and it, who are just there, who are like internal sort of stats. Analysts or statisticians, but then yeah, we do need to get better at reaching out to the other analysts. So I don't know as much about the other, like the geographers and the actuaries and the people in the other analytical professions, because I've always kind of been in the stats and research sort of area side of it, which is the big part of it, obviously.
Wow, that's really interesting to know that much goes on within government. I mean, and all of that influences everything that we as sort of citizens experience.
Yeah, there's a lot of analysis and spreadsheets and stuff going on that inform a lot of public services that you might not really realise exists, but it does.
So how did sort of your attitude and your work relate to the people you met at this event? Did you feel like there are others there of the same mould as you, or were you an odd one out?
No, I think everyone there was there with a reason. The main reason was to like communicate maths better to people. And there was kind of discussion about, because it was called communicate maths for the public, but the public doesn't exist. Like the general public isn't the thing. Is that you have to like know a bit more about the audience that you're speaking to. And that's like the most important thing when you're preparing to speak to anyone or preparing something to go out. So I didn't feel odd. I felt like everyone was kind of on the same page with that. So it was just really interesting to bowl, and I used to work in a role that was a sort of data journalist role, and I would talk to a lot of analysts in ONS and statisticians in ONS. And when you sit down and talk to stats and statisticians and analysts about the work they do, like I say, it's always lovely when someone really loves their subject and knows everything about it. And I used to have chats at meetings with people, and they'd be so interesting. They talk all about their stats and all the different like quirks that are in their stats. I used to love working on vital statistics stats, so births, deaths, marriages, divorces. They were always my favorite things to write stories about, and the people would always know really. So I did one story that was about marriages and how people in like the 50s and 40s used to get married at the end of the tax year. I think I'm remembering it right. So March was like a really big popular time for weddings, and it was because if you were a married man at the end of the tax year, you could claim your married man tax allowance for the whole of the past tax year. So if you're going to get married anyway, don't wait until the summer. Get married now, because then you can claim back the tax for all the tax year that's just gone. Something like that. I did a whole piece on it. And I can never remember the intricacies of it, but there's something to do with like, loads of weddings in March. And then they changed the tax, because married men used to be able to claim more because you were supporting your wife. So you could claim more tax if you were a married man than if you were a single man. But then obviously that changed, and you didn't get that bonus for being married. So people started getting married in the summer. And like that was just something people knew, like they knew about, the statisticians knew about it. But I was like, oh, that's so interesting. So I can't remember where I've come from with this now. But your people, I think everyone who knows a lot about this subject is really interesting to talk to, because they always know quirks and stuff that you wouldn't necessarily know about. So I didn't find it odd in that setting, because I always find people talking about stuff they know about engaging, and they're just not always good at presentations.
That's great. I loved hearing that. I think all the romance has gone from the world when things like that don't exist anymore.
I wanted to call them mercenary newlyweds, but that got edited out of my my beat.
So something of a journalistic background then yourself?
Well, a little bit. So I worked in the digital publishing area of ONS when it started. I think I could say ONS. I always try to avoid acronyms, but I think we know Office for National Statistics. So I worked in digital publishing for a bit, and I sort of fell into the data journalist role. They weren't called data journalist roles then. We were just working on the content design team, and I was doing some of the writing, some of the working with the business areas. but yeah, I really loved that role. It was a really interesting to work, but it was quite stressful, but it was really interesting as well.
And what was before that point for you? Were you a maths graduate?
Yeah, I did maths and economics at Bristol Uni. I wanted to be a teacher, so everything was always geared to being a teacher. So I didn't really ever consider any other career options. And then I taught for 3 years, and I loved teaching economics, and I loved teaching A-level maths, but I really was not suited to, like, Key Stage 3. I never taught GCSE maths, but I Key Stage 3 maths, I really feel like the curriculum is not that fun, and it's quite repetitive, and it's just really hard. And because I was doing economics as well, that took economics. I love economics, but you have to read a lot. You have to know what's going on in the world to make it interesting, to make it real. You have to. It's just a lot of prep, and so I just didn't have the time to like make the Key Stage 3 math lessons exciting because of trying to make the economics stuff interesting. And so yeah, I found that hard. So I ended up. My school was right around the corner from ONS, and I went on a day to ONS it's meant to be helping teachers bring stats into the classroom. And I went there and I was like, oh, this looks like such a nicer place to work. I ended up moving over. But yeah, that's kind of, what my background was. And I moved over and I was in the labour market analysis for a little bit. But that was also really good. I had the first thing I ever wrote in that role got on the front page of every newspaper. So that really ruined me because it was on underemployment. And I obviously I thought then everything I write is going to end up on the front page of every national newspaper. It's never happened again. So, but yeah, that's kind of how my route.
Oh, well, I can hear the excitement in your voice and the animation. So it was obviously a journey you weren't thinking twice about. It was very appealing as you sort of fell into it.
I think there obviously are roles in ONS that are probably a bit drier. We can go into them. But the one I fell into was... be good. And then I think if you take control of your career and then you go to the places you want to go, then you'll always be interested in what you're doing.
I've been monopolizing the questions so far, but Maha actually is a mathematician, so she can she can ask you questions which are more relevant perhaps to our eager audience who are listening. So I don't know if you wanted to ask about how the work done by government analysis function relates to math at all, Maha, whatever direction you want to go with that.
Yeah, so my next question was going to be on, so in your talk you were talking about data visualization and digital accessibility, and I'm assuming that's a big part of your current role, and I was just wondering what, so you gave some examples there about how, during the event, about how you can make things easier for people to when they're looking at charts or trying to access the ONS charts online, things like that. How much of that is your role? I mean, do you do other things in your role at the government analysis function? Just curious to know.
Yeah, so our team is all about supporting. It's like a general thing, so anything to do with communicating data, stats, and analysis. But there was a big sort of gap in support for accessibility. And I was managing the GSS website at that point a couple of years ago, and then the government legislation came in, so all public sector websites have a legal obligation to meet certain accessibility criteria, and that came in 2020. So 2020 is obviously a really odd year. A lot of my team got taken off to go work on the slides for the number 10 briefings, but I was left managing the website because I had a 1-year-old and a 5-year-old at home. So I couldn't really do the high pressure making slides for the national briefings. And so I was doing the accessibility stuff instead. So making the website accessible first, and then we realized there was this big gap. So lots and lots of people started asking for, how do we make the documents accessible? How do we make spreadsheets accessible? So spreadsheets was the first thing. Spreadsheets are not easy to make accessible, but I did like a bunch of research, and I found that there are lots of things we can do to make them much better, much easier for people to use, regardless of like any health impairment or disability. And then it kind of went on. So then people started asking about colours. So we looked into sort of colours to use in charts. And then charts in more generally then. So I guess the biggest thing with charts is like the alternative text around charts and how you provide that and how you can, again, make things so that everyone can access them regardless of their different needs they might have. So it kind of, I sort of fell into accessibility because there's big demand for it. But it has become our main sort of part of our work, but we are here for any sort of communication advice. And like later in the year, we're going on to looking at writing about analysis and how we can be better at writing about stats and analysis. That's like the next step. But I ended up knowing a lot about accessibility sort of by accident.
Yeah, no, I mean, it's something really important, obviously. And I saw that, I think you were also speaking to Nick Holliman from King's College London as well at the event, and he's also heavily involved in data visualization and things. I'm wondering, did you get anything from the event that made you think, oh, okay, maybe we can take that into account when in your day-to-day job or anything like that?
I think it was about making contacts and meeting other people and what they're doing. I think one of the there was Tom Whipple was there, was the science correspondent.
At the
so
Times.
He was really interesting to talk to because he was sort of talking about his frustration about how hard it is to get statisticians to talk about their work to the media. Not so much, he wasn't complaining about ONS very much because ONS are independent, I think they have an easier time of it, and they sort of pushed that more in the office so that to get statisticians to talk directly to the media and to give sort of quotes up front. But across government, and I found that really interesting to talk to him because when I was working as an analyst in ONS, I wasn't media trained. I wasn't senior enough to be media trained. And if sometimes you would, somebody would somehow get your number and your desk phone would ring, and then it would be like somebody asking you for, and you just have to be like, oh my God, no, I can't speak to you. So there's a lot of nervousness around speaking to the media, I think, when you work in government. So I think that I've reached out to him over Twitter since to sort of say, like, I'd really like you to come and talk, because even though I'm based in ONS, we help everyone across government, so across all the different departments. So I said, I'd really love it if you could come and talk to the people across all the government departments about why it would be so good if more of them would talk directly to you and how that would help get the message out there. Because I think that's how a lot of misconceptions and misreporting happens, is a lot of time you just can't find the person you need to talk to. And even if it's just like off the record, just so like the person can understand the stuff, it doesn't have to be given a direct quote and stuff. So yeah, I think talking to him was really, really interesting. That's probably I've reached out to him already. And a couple of other people who actually work in ONS, I thought, I didn't know that they were doing that. So I've also reached out to them to link up better with them.
Yeah. So you spoke about like Tom Whipple as a journalist would want from the civil service. How about what you're looking for from the wider communicating maths community, or just the maths community in general? What would you ask for from them?
Oh, well, we just want to get more of our team, because our team is across government, so I guess we just want to get more people to know about our team and that they can come to us and ask us for help. So that's like one of our big objectives across the, and I guess for me, it was to talking about accessibility stuff, and not a lot of people. Well, if you know, because the legislation doesn't apply to you if you're not a public sector website. But then I was talking to people about university websites, and university websites are public sector websites, so the legislation does apply to them. So I had a couple of people talk to me about that, so I was happy also to get that message out. Because when you start working on something like accessibility and empathizing more with the different people's needs, I think you do get really annoyed that things aren't as accessible as possible. And I was thinking the other day about how, like, no, not really that long ago, you wouldn't have had ramp access everywhere. Like, it would just not been, you know, it wouldn't have been, and disabled toilets everywhere. And, like, how weird that is to us now. Like, you can't imagine that. And, like, as soon as you've had a child, if you try to get in a pram around, and you, and then you realise, oh, my, I can't believe, obviously, people had prams before ramp access was everywhere. And what did you do before you could use that? And then, and disabled toilets, because you can't take a pram into, when you go into like a normal toilet cubicle, you either have to make the choice to leave your baby outside the toilet cubicle or leave the cubicle door open. And so disabled toilets are also useful for you as a mother when you've got a pram, because you can go in there quickly, use that, and then leave it, and you don't have to leave your baby like unattended. So I think that you do get more passionate about making things accessible to all people the more you work in it. So I guess what I want from them is to be more aware of the accessibility needs of different people and what they're publishing online. And I was talking to, I've forgotten her name, the doctor who came and gave the talk about diagnostic tests. I can't remember her name.
Jessica.
We were speaking about medical records and how they might be trying to move medical records online, and how, you know, they definitely need to be made accessible. If people are going to access their own medical records online, like, everyone needs to access them. And a lot of people who might want to access them might have access needs that you know, need to be met by the person who's publishing them. So, getting that message out there about accessibility to anyone communicating anything, really, but particularly communicating maths.
What are the most common pitfalls for accessibility? What's the most common ways in which information can't be accessed?
Oh, well, a lot of people get stuck on with accessibility is that screen reader. So they tend to think of screen readers and they think, okay, people who can't see the screen and then they have to have the content read out to them. And then what must that be, you know, trying to find ways of fixing that. And obviously it's not always possible. Like when I was talking to Nick about his data viz, like how you, if you're doing some very intricate, very detailed, beautiful data viz, it's very hard to make to someone who can't see that. To how would you do anything that can come close to giving the equivalent experience of something like that? So sometimes it's really hard. But I've got my train of thought now. What was the question?
Other ways in which
the main pitfalls. Yeah, so people get stuck on the screen reader thing, and the screen reader thing is a big thing. But there are lots of other things. So people who aren't sight impaired, but maybe they can't see colour, like the most of people see colour. So that's obviously one that trips a lot of people up, and it's not easy to do either. Like we've discovered for line charts, once you've got more than two lines, there just aren't enough colours in the world, in the spectrum, to have enough contrast between all the lines and the white background. And that's something I didn't know until I looked into doing the colours research. So in terms of using colour, just knowing a few extra tips around colour. So one of the things is that sometimes you want to use a sequential palette. So maybe you've got age ranges. So you want to go from like a light blue to a dark blue going up in the ages. And if you do that on a bar chart, if for the very light blue, you can put like an outline around it. So someone even can't see the light blue against the white background, they can like read off the outline. So it's just tips and tricks. Just think about things you might not think about. And that's what a lot of people come up to me after, or message me after, saying, oh, I never thought about that. I never considered that. There's just lots of little things, that little edits, and like using, I think I mentioned it in the talk, but using automatic colour on a spreadsheet or on a Word document. Don't colour your text black, colour it automatic, and then if someone opens it and they've got different settings to you because they need to see, they don't like white on black, they can't see black on white, they need it to be like blue on beige, if you select automatic, that it'll work automatically for them, whereas if you select black, it'll just show black, and then they won't be able to, or they'll have to fiddle with their settings. So yeah, it's just little things that don't occur to you unless you have that particular need.
Yeah, that's really fascinating.
So I was going to go on to possibly asking you about your plans for the future in your role. So what things, so you've been looking at data visualization, accessibility, and you mentioned that you're also involved in other things at the government analysis function. So what are those, and also what are your future plans in this role?
Yeah, so for this year, we've been working on DataBiz e-learning, because we used to do a lot of DataBiz training. So we used to go around to a lot of government departments, and we travel there. We do maybe a day's training with a load of people from different government departments, and then we'd all get really good feedback, and it'd be really good, and it was good training. But then nothing actually, it never really fed through to changes in publications. So people tend to go on training, don't they? And then they like the training and everything, but then we don't really know why nothing fed through to changes. But certain things, like we talk about colour, but then the department would have their own colour palette, and they'd have to go and back and use that colour palette. So what we tried to do was that took up so much of our time that we thought, oh, it's not really being that effective. So we're going to put e-learning out there, so if people want to just have an introduction to the database, so that's on there. I'm massively love e-learning, we try to make it, as first of all, accessible, so it's all in HTML. There's no fancy program to go in, and then we try to put activities in throughout it, little things to do, and then exercises at the end. So we've tried to make it as engaging as we can, as informative as we can. And we're doing more and more work on it to edit it and test it and go on that. So that's the big thing we're working on at the moment. So that is there as a standalone resource, so people can come and use it, so we haven't got to go out and travel everywhere to teach the people the stuff. So then we have more time. I would really love to go out and do some sort of, be more based, like a sort of consultancy. So people would say, oh, look, we're publishing this report. We want to make it more accessible. We want the database to be better. And then we get to work with a team on a report or something they're working on, because then you can actual change. You can see the impact you're having. And then, like I said, the next thing, the big piece of guidance my team is going to work on is the writing. Because it exists. There is writing about stats guidance, but it hasn't been updated for about 4 or 5 years. So just to make sure it's incorporating all the accessibility stuff, but then it's also up to date in what it's saying. That's the big thing.
So is the audience for that civil servants, or is it also for the wider public? Or
so I always like to put our guidance and everything out publicly available. So because we do get requests from people outside government for advice and stuff, or if they can access the stuff we provide. Lots of charity sector a lot of the time ask for stuff like that. So everything's always on the analysis function website, publicly available. But yes, it's written with government in mind, because they're the ones who've got to meet the certain criteria, and they've got to, that's who we're here to support, basically. So government analysts.
Great. And for the benefit of the listeners, that's analysisfunction.civilservice.gov.uk.
Yes, it took a long time to get that domain. You wouldn't believe
it. Well, there are 10 other people wanting exactly that one, were there?
Oh, well, we weren't allowed to have analysisfunction.gov.uk. That's what we wanted, but we were not allowed to have that. So we had to have the service. So we had to make it that little bit longer.
Okay.
So, yeah.
Yeah, there has to be that ownership there. Very clear signposting, this is the civil service.
Well, and also, it's part of the thing about that is annoying, is it's also local government. So we're also here to support local government, but local government are not civil servants, they're public servants. So that's the reason why we didn't want to have civil service in the domain, but we had to have it because we couldn't. There's no other way around it, so we had to go for that one. Just shout out to all the local government people. We are here for you.
Excellent. The link's in the show description for anyone listening, so you can find that there. And yes, information which is relevant to the wider public as well as to the public sector, as you just pointed out. That's great. Maha, were there any other questions you wanted to ask before?
No, that's all from me.
Super. Well, thank you. I wanted to ask you, it's putting you on the spot a little bit, Hannah, but of the talks you saw when you were at the event, which did you find the most interesting?
Well, obviously, Hannah Fry and David Spiegelhalter are the most refinement. No, they're obviously really do that for a lot of the time, so that both those talks are really good. I also really like the producer for More or Less. I think it's very brave when anyone stands up and no slides and he just talked off a piece of paper, but he was obviously they were all really interesting, and sort of talking about busting misconceptions and stuff. I think part of his talks about, and I've always thought that I always loved doing that. It's really interesting.
The program More or Less and everything that David Spiegelhalter, that I've seen him do at least, I mean, they couldn't be more similar, couldn't they? It's wonderfully, I mean, you know, insightful from both, and wildly entertaining from David when he chooses to be, and then just like sort of shocking and stunning from more or less on a weekly basis about misinterpretation of scientific fact.
And just how hard it is, I think. Just like, you know, it is, you have to go away and research it and work out all the, like, this is the caveat and these are the things that you need to bear in mind and stuff. And I also did really love, I think it was Rowan, he was the philosopher, so it was an interesting take on, an interesting addition, a completely different type of talk, talking about, philosophy of stuff. That's good.
Oh, well, great. Well, thank you very much for sharing those thoughts. We've kept you for about half an hour, and I think I've run out of the penetrating and interesting questions that I'd prepared for you. But thank you for giving up such a portion of your day. And I guess we very much hope to see you at future Gateway or Isaac Newton Institute events, should, you know, when they appear, that would be suitable for you to attend.
Yeah, I'd love to.
And thank you both very much for joining, and have a great rest of the day.
And you. Thanks.